This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. I've watched baseball for a long time, and the more I see, the more I appreciate catchers. They aren't like the outfielders, gracefully loping under fly balls, or infielders diving for grounders. They're baseball's anonymous brutes, hidden behind masks and crouched behind the plate, eating dust from pitches in the dirt and getting clipped by foul balls. But the position is incredibly demanding, both physically and mentally. Besides doing 150 knee bends a day and absorbing collisions at the plate, catchers have to study hitters and call just the right pitches and manage the delicate psyches of their pitchers, young and old. I wanted to talk to a veteran catcher about the life he leads, and people who know steered me to Brad Ausmus. He retired last year after 18 seasons in the big leagues, 10 of them with the Houston Astros. He's a 3-time Gold Glove winner and was named to the 1999 National League All-Star team. He caught more than 1,900 games in all, good for 7th place on the all-time list. He's now a special assistant to the general manager of the San Diego Padres. I spoke to Brad Ausmus last week. Brad Ausmus, welcome to Fresh Air. As a catcher, your role is unique. You and the pitcher are busy on every play, while 7 other guys, although they will do tremendous things from time to time, are standing around. Tell us, describe, if you will, some of the physical demands of catching in the big leagues.
Physically, it's mainly getting in and out of a squat. You do it not only during the course of the game, which is actually the easier part. You do it in the bullpen. You do it in spring training. You do it during the warm-ups. You do it prior to the game. At times, I've tried to total up the number of squats I've gotten into over the course of a season, and you'd have to go 150 squats a day for 7 months, and you'd come up with the number. So your legs take a toll, especially when you get down to the last 2 months of the season. In August and September, you start to feel your legs getting tired. I remember walking up the stairs one season when I had a newborn, my second daughter, and I would walk halfway up the stairs to the landing, and I'd kind of have to rest because my legs were tired. So there is a physical demand mostly on your legs.
And I imagine that you like a pitcher who works quickly. I mean, you're there crouching, and somebody who takes his time, you know, picks up the rosin bag, thinks it over, rubs his forehead. while you're there crouching, does that make your day tougher?
It definitely makes it tougher. When you have a pitcher who works quickly, not only works quickly in the sense that gets the ball, gets back on the pitching rubber, and is prepared to get the sign and go, but works quickly in the sense that myself, as the catcher and the pitcher, are on the same page in terms of what pitch should be used in this situation against this hitter in this game. And there's not much shaking off going on. The pitcher's constantly in agreement with the catcher. That's the games that are fun and go quickly.
Now, you have those deep knee bends you're doing all day, or at least all through the game and the warm-ups. But there are those times in the game when you get nicked. Now, I imagine the equipment's probably improved since you first started, right? The protective equipment?
It's improved, yes. It's improved and become a lot more comfortable, actually.
Yeah? In what ways?
When I first started, really, the inside of the shin guards protecting your legs was just hard rubber. And now they're rubber lined with cloth, and it's a lot easier, especially when sometimes you get gravel or dirt in between your legs and the shin guard, and this new material softens it, and it's not constantly grinding on your skin. But there's been improvements in other areas. The chest protectors, they now have a slow-release foam rather than just being stuffed like a stuffed animal with fabric or some type of fiber. And, of course, nowadays catchers have a choice of masks. They can go with the old-style mask and helmet combination, or they can go with the relatively new style in the last 12 or so years of the hockey mask, which has become pretty popular.
And why is the hockey mask better?
Well, being a former hockey mask wearer, I liked it for a number of reasons. One, it provided protection for the entire head. So if the hitter on his backswing came all the way around and hit you towards the back of the mask, your head was still protected in the hockey-style mask, more so than it would be in the old-style mask. But also the bars were thinner and closer to your face, which gave you better viewing through the mask, and you could see the field better, see the pitch better, see any ball being thrown to you better. Thirdly and finally was with the new style mask, you never had to take it off. You know, when you wore the old style catching mask, the helmet was generally turned backwards and the brim of the hat faced backwards. So if there was a pop-up or a foul ball that you were chasing and you looked up, what would happen is the brim would hit your upper back or the back of your shoulders, and it would cause the mask to jostle. As a result, catchers constantly have to remove their mask for a foul ball or a pop-up. With the catching style mask, there is no brim in the back, so you can move your head in all directions without changing your view or jostling the helmet itself or the mask itself. So you could leave it on a pop-up. You don't even have to remove it and worry about throwing it to the side or stepping on it or hitting the umpire with it.
Right. Do you catch one-handed with your bare hand behind your back for protection, or do you keep both hands out there?
Well, it changes based on the situation. If there's nobody on base, I keep my right hand or my throwing hand kind of to my side by my hip and down a little bit to protect it from a foul ball. Back 50 years ago, before there was changes in the catcher's mitt, it used to be just basically a pillow with a hole in the middle or a dent in the middle that catchers would have to catch the ball and immediately put their throwing hand over it so it wouldn't pop out. And there's been a lot of changes in the catcher's mitt. It's hinged and it has a webbing. You don't really need two hands to catch the ball. So when there's nobody on base, the throwing hand, in order to protect it, is either behind me or down by my right hip. Now, if there's a runner on base that could possibly steal, or I need to be concerned with the ball in the dirt not getting by me, then I bring my hand and I actually lay it relaxed on the groin area or the inner thigh of my right leg, and it just kind of hangs there flat against my inner thigh. And it's in a good position there to either block the ball in the dirt or to be ready to throw a base stealer out.
And you hope you don't get a foul tip into that exposed arm or hand.
You're right, and it's a precarious position. What I've found is, first, in 18 years in the major leagues, I may have gotten hit in that spot 10 times. It doesn't get hit very often. I've also found that if you keep your hand relaxed when you do get hit, there's usually no damage. And I can say, over the course of my entire career, there was only one foul ball that hit my throwing hand that caused me to miss any time. I missed two or three games when I was playing for the Houston Astros. But other than that, it's usually like any other foul tip. You shake it off and you move forward.
So a guy's 58 feet away, throwing 90 miles an hour, a batter swinging in front of my eyes, and I'm staying relaxed.
That's the goal.
Now, you mentioned balls in the dirt. They're a terrific weapon for your pitcher. I mean, to get a batter lunging at a ball that's dropping out of the strike zone. And so you get a lot of ground balls and a lot of strikes that way, and that's good for your team. But there's also the risk that ball can get past you, the catcher, and a base runner can advance. You were known for being good at stopping balls in the dirt. Any particular tricks you used?
There's no trick to it. And really, the important thing about keeping balls in front of you, this is how I often explain it. If I was a basketball player and somebody took a jump shot and I swatted the ball into the stands, blocking a shot, everyone might ooh and ah. But the truth of the matter is that team gets the ball back because it went out of bounds, so it doesn't do us any good. That is very similar to catching. You can't just block the ball. You have to control the ball, because if you block it and it ricochets more than 5 feet away from you, the runner's going to advance anyway, and it hasn't done you any good. So my whole theory on blocking was controlling the ball, kind of catching the ball with my chest protector and keeping it close to me, because if it went too far, we're in a worse predicament.
Now, I want to talk about collisions at the plate. There are some collisions in baseball, like occasionally outfielders will collide with each other or the wall, and sometimes it happens among base runners. But the one time in baseball that a collision is intentional and accepted is when a runner is coming in from third, the catcher is waiting for a throw from a fielder, and the catcher's got to catch that ball, make the tag on the runner, and if you block the plate, they're allowed to plow into you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You are free game.
Tell us about how that worked. I mean, would you block the plate and thereby induce a collision, or would you like to give them a path so that they would slide and try and avoid the tag? How did you approach that?
You know, every play at the plate can be slightly different, but going into it, this was my general approach. The ball gets hit to the outfield. There's a runner at second base. I know there's a possible play at the plate as soon as the ball's hit. So I get my feet set, usually at the front left corner is where I put my left foot and I kind of point my toe towards third base, because if that runner slides into me, I don't want to have my toe pointed towards the pitcher's mound and now the runner slides into the side of my knee. So I'm setting my feet ahead of time. And as the play develops, you get a sense by looking back and forth and through your peripheral vision if there's going to be a play or not. And as the throw comes in, what happens more often than not is the throw takes you to where you go, because you have to catch the ball and apply the tag. So you have to go where the throw is. If it does come right to you and there's time to catch the ball and set, then that's probably when you're going to get hit. The general rule as a base runner is if you're running towards home and the catcher is about to catch the ball or already has the ball, that's when you want to hit him. That's when you want to either jostle him just before he catches it, or hit him hard enough where he drops it. And that's really the only time where the contact comes into play at home plate.
You want to tell us one of your more memorable encounters there?
I've one clearly stands out above the rest. I was playing in Houston, and we were playing against the Milwaukee Brewers, and a player named Scott Posednik was on second base, and there was a base hit to center field where Carlos Beltran was playing, and there was going to be a play at the plate. The throw, kind of as I described, took me a little bit to my right, and I had to reach with my gloved left hand and come back towards home plate. And as I came back towards home plate, Scott Posednik hit me on the left side of my shoulder and mask, and I was actually spun around. My helmet came flying off, and I was unconscious for about 5 or 10 seconds.
Wow. I hate to ask you this, but did you hold the ball?
You know, it's ironically, I did. I didn't know it. I held onto the ball, and I landed face first in the dirt, and the pitcher, who was backing up home plate in case of an overthrow, had to come over and take the ball out of my glove while I was unconscious in case the runner at first, who had had the original single, tried to advance to the next base. And Scott Posednik, who had plowed into me and knocked me out, was actually called out.
Yeah. I mean, typically the umpire just looks to see if the catcher holds on to the ball, and if he does, it's an out, right?
Yeah, generally that's how it works. If there's a collision, they're assuming a tag was applied. And more often than not, that's the case.
Do you think the rule should change? I mean, you know, this doesn't happen at second base or third base where guys just go barreling into a fielder. And I got to see, even though as a catcher you've got some protection, the momentum is with the base runner. I mean, I remember Pete Rose actually ended the career of a catcher in the All-Star game once by plowing into him. Should the rule change?
No, I don't think there should be any rule changes other than with one caveat. I would say maybe take away the head hits. Any contact by the base runner at the catcher's head or above his shoulders could be deemed illegal. That way, with all the new studies and discoveries concerning concussions, you might be able to avoid some post-playing career issues, medical issues. But other than that, home plate's different. Home plate is not second base. Home plate is not third base. When you cross home plate, you've scored a run, and one run can make the difference in a game. So for me, being a catcher, even though I know I could have been hurt while trying to block home plate or trying to apply a tag at home plate's not third base. If someone slides into third base, that's not going to win the game for them. If someone slides into home plate and they've crossed it and tagged it, that could win the game for them. And the axiom in baseball is one game can be the difference between a playoff team and a team that goes home and plays golf. So one run could be the difference.
I want to talk about what happens there at the plate with the umpire. I mean, you're behind the plate. The batter's at the back of the batter's box. The ump is crouching over your shoulder. You're kind of almost a unit there. I mean, do you and the umpire sort of work together? Is there sort of a choreographed dance there?
Generally speaking, the umpire works around the catcher. There are some umpires who like to place a hand on the catcher's shoulder or side. Kind of lines them up and gives them, they know where they are and gives them their view of the strike zone. And, you know, 99% of the catchers have no problem with it. And sometimes the umpire will even say, hey, does my hand on your shoulder bother you? And once again, I think 99% of the catchers say, no, don't worry about it. As long as the umpire is not actually pushing you in any way when you're trying to catch the ball, it's usually not an issue. The umpire is kind of setting up around the catcher, but you are, in a sense, working together. And, you know, I will have umpires, or I have had umpires say, hey, I'm having trouble seeing the inside pitch. Can you get a little lower? And generally, you try to accommodate the umpire. You know, this guy's making decisions on balls and strikes. The last thing you want to do is make him angry. So you are working together, and you get to know these guys. These, you know, people from the stands are yelling blue or four eyes, you know, whatever they have for the umpire. But, you know, you get to know the umpires by name. You have a rapport with them. You know who you can joke around with, who you can't. So there is a relationship there that goes beyond business.
And can you work an umpire? I mean, I guess one of the things you do is when a close pitch comes in, you try and frame it for the umpire and make them give it the appearance of a strike, right? And that's something I'm told you were known for doing well.
Yeah, you want to get every pitch you can. And my whole premise was the less movement you had, the less distracted the umpire is, the more likely the umpire is to think it's a strike. If there's a lot of movement, he's thinking you're reaching for the ball. It can't be where you wanted it. Maybe it was a ball. Or sometimes just the movement of a catcher itself can distract the umpire. So my whole theory was as little movement as possible and make the ball look like it's in the center of my body. So there was a slight shift of my upper body as I tried to catch the ball towards the center of my chest protector in a spot where the umpire could see it. I don't mean catch it literally on my chest protector, but directly in front of my sternum, I would try and catch it with slight shifts from side to side, no sudden movements.
Now, if you're not getting the close calls from the umpire, can you work them at all?
You can. Early in the game, generally speaking, I'm going to let the umpire kind of establish where his strike zone is. These guys aren't computers. Not every umpire has the exact same strike zone. There are slight variations, and I don't mind the variations as long as these variations hold true for the entire nine innings. If they've established their strike zone in a certain manner in the first two innings or so, I don't want to see that strike zone change when we get into the eighth inning and now the game is on the line and he misses a call that he's called all day. So as long as they're consistent with their strike zones, you know, I don't think anyone really has a problem with it.
And what is it? Tell me what it sounds like when you admonish an umpire or work him in a circumstance like that, where you think they've changed their strike zone.
It would depend on the situation. If it's the first time I disagree with them, it'd be very congenial. And one general rule I stuck to was I didn't really admonish an umpire or argue or question an umpire while there was a hitter within earshot. Even if it was only the second pitch of the at-bat and the at-bat went eight pitches, I would wait till that hitter was gone before I said something to the umpire. And usually if it was one or the first or second pitch that I disagree with, I'd ask him, hey, where did you have that curveball that he threw, second pitch? And the umpire might say, oh, I had it outside. And I said, I thought it caught the corner. That right there sends a message, all right? He knows that I thought it was a strike, even if he had the pitch being outside. Now, if this happens again and again, or he consistently misses pitches that I think are strikes, if he later in the game doesn't call something a strike that he had called earlier in the game, then it can get a little bit more volatile. And believe it or not, sometimes you don't even have to say anything. You can just hold the pitch a little bit longer or not throw it back to the pitcher as quickly. Body language speaks as loud as words.
And the rule is you're not allowed to argue balls and strikes. You can be ejected for that, right? So you kind of have to be subtle about it.
You can. But the umpire will give you some leeway in terms of disagreeing with them. Umpires know they're not going to get 100% of the pitches right. And as long as you're not complaining every single inning, every single game they're behind home plate, they really don't have a problem with you disagreeing with them. I think as a catcher, you need to understand that these guys have a job to do. The large majority of them are doing the best they can. You know, they don't have vendettas against players, generally speaking. That rarely happens. They don't hold grudges. One of the first things they're taught is they can't hold grudges. They're trying to get every pitch right. They're being evaluated on it. And there's no animosity that the umpires harbor, for the most part, against players. They want to get the call right.
One of the most important things a catcher does is to call the pitches that the pitcher is going to throw. I mean, people who watch the game know that between your legs you will drop typically, I guess, one finger to signal a fastball and then two, three, or four for various other pitches that the pitcher might throw, curveball, a slider, a changeup. And When you see this working well, it's interesting. You will see the pitcher get the ball back and this then almost go into the windup immediately. And I'm thinking for that to happen, the catcher must be making the decision on what pitch to call immediately as soon as the last pitch is completed. Does it work that quickly? I mean, is that what you do?
Basically, yes. That's exactly what happens. A pitch is thrown, and as soon as you've thrown it back, there's kind of a checklist that you go through, and it becomes more reflexive as you do it more and more. And a veteran catcher, a lot of the checklist he just glosses over because he knows the answer to it. But you're really going through a bunch of different things in your mind, including what's the score, what inning you're in, how many outs, what's this hitter's weaknesses, what is this pitcher's strengths, who's on deck, how did we get this guy out last time, what pitches did he see, what pitch did we just throw? So, I mean, there's about 10 to a dozen things that you kind of, a checklist you go through in your mind before you put that signal down.
Right, and then you can pick from four or five pitches that the pitcher throws, and it can be up or down or inside or outside. That's a lot of options that you've got to get through in a hurry.
It is, and you prepare for it. You know, it's that checklist you go through before every single pitch, but a lot of it happens beforehand. You know, we have pitcher and catcher meetings. On the teams I've played with, the catchers would get together and go over the entire offensive lineup or potential lineup, their strengths, their weaknesses, what can they run, do they hit and run, are they bunters. Before every series, I would have a stack of graphs, and they would have each hitter on the opposing team, what they did against right-handed, what they did against left-handed pitchers, what they did against curveballs and sliders against right-handed and left-handed pitchers, what they did against changeups and split-fingered fastballs against right-handed and left-handed pitchers. And this all gets condensed down into basically a sheet or a chart of strengths, weaknesses. And you use that as your cheat sheet before the game and when you're going over the lineup with the pitcher of that day. And so this all this decisions that go on during the course of the game, this starts long before the games begin. And in fact, you could even make the argument that when a new pitcher comes to a team, it starts all the way back in spring training when you are catching this new pitcher to your team and you're figuring out what is his strengths, what are his best pitches, what is his best off-speed pitch. And all this knowledge gets applied when you get into the game with that pitcher and you have to call pitches.
How many hours a week would you spend just doing the mental work? I mean, outside the game, just studying stuff, making graphs.
Well, I would do the graphs before every series, and that would take me a couple hours. And then you go over each lineup on a given day, which would only take about 20 minutes. And then I would spend another 20 minutes every game that I was catching going over the chart myself and looking at that day's opposing lineup and just giving myself a little refresher of what the strengths and weaknesses are of each player in the opposing team's lineup.
So a catcher then who knows his pitcher and knows all of the hitter's tendencies and calls a great game is a tremendous asset, and I think people in baseball know this. And frankly, people who write about you say that you were one of the best at this. Adam Dunn, who is, of course, a terrific left-handed power hitter, is said of you, as a hitter, I hate him, because you were known for doing this well. You've also, though, got to handle your pitcher's psyche. If the pitcher's out there getting frustrated, not hitting his spots, and you trot out, I'm sure every conversation is different. But do you have to know, I don't know, do some pitchers bristle if you make a suggestion? Is it a matter of simple encouragement? Is it strategy? What do you say when you get out there and talk to them?
The one general rule I had, and this didn't apply every single time I went out to talk to a pitcher. There are times where I would have to get on a pitcher. But my general rule was when I left the pitcher's mound after talking to any given pitcher, I want them to feel like they can get out of this situation. You know, baseball's a tough game. It's not as physically demanding as, say, football or hockey. But it's a tough game in the sense that it's pitch after pitch after pitch for 150 pitches a game for six straight months with very few days of rest. So when I left that mound, I wanted that pitcher, even if he was in the worst situation possible, if he was in bases loaded, no outs, with the tying run at third base in the bottom of the ninth inning, when I left that pitcher's mound, I wanted that pitcher to feel like, hey, I got a chance to get out of this. So my general rule was to be positive. Unless it was a guy who I knew could handle a little yelling or a little berating. I was generally very calm, and I walked away hoping that they felt like this is not an impossible situation.
And when somebody could take a little berating, what would you berate them about?
Usually when I was berating someone is because they were pitching what I would call scared. They were trying to avoid contact, or they were afraid that the hitter was going to hit the ball. In sports in general, you can't be afraid of failure, but in baseball, there's so much failure, you really can't be afraid of it. So the only time I would berate a pitcher or get on a pitcher would be when I felt like they were pitching scared on the mound and that they were trying to avoid contact because they were afraid of what was going to happen. So unless you were doing that, like I said, my general rule was to walk away with them feeling they could get out of that situation.
You know, Crash Davis, the catcher in Bull Durham, said you play the game with fear and arrogance. Did you like that movie?
I did like it. Yeah, it was a good movie.
There's a moment in that film where his young pitcher, Newt LaLoosh, is shaking off his signs. And he says, I can't believe this guy's shaking off my signs. And after conversing with him at the mound, Newt wanted to throw his fastball against a guy who always looks for a first ball fastball. The catcher then, Kevin Costner, tells the batter what's coming. Did you get irritated when young pitchers would shake your signs off?
I did. There were times where I did get irritated, especially later in my career when I felt like I had a generally pretty good knowledge of the hitters and situations. I don't mind being shaken off, and I would never make a pitcher throw a pitch he doesn't want to throw, because if he doesn't believe in it, it's not going to be successful even if it's the right pitch. I'd rather have him throw what he wants to throw even if it's the wrong pitch. But it would bother me at times when a young pitcher who had never seen the hitters before would come up and start shaking. It would also bother me sometimes when a pitcher would come out of the bullpen for the first time in a series, and maybe it's the third game of a four-game series, and he hasn't pitched or seen any of these hitters, and I've seen him for three straight days, and he'd come out and start shaking. Does that make me right and them wrong? Absolutely not. Like I said, I would rather they throw the wrong pitch with conviction than throw the right pitch half-heartedly. That being said, there are times, too, where I'll put a sign down and they'll shake, and I'll put it down again and they'll shake, and I'll put it down a third time and they'll go, okay.
Okay. This is the pitch. Now, this gets sensitive. Did you ever call for your pitcher to plunk a batter? I mean, this is a part of the game, they say, situations where you might throw at somebody or throw close to them.
Yeah. Yes, I have. You know, there are times where a team or a player kind of breaks the baseball code. You know, whether it's trying to steal a base late in the game when the opponent had a big lead and didn't need to be stealing bases and scoring more runs, trying to stick it to us or show us up. If an opponent slides into our second baseman with cleats high, looks like he's trying to injure him. You know, there are times where you kind of take law into your own hands.
Would those calls come from the dugout, or would they come from you?
Both. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had managers tell me they want player X to be hit, and there's been times where I've walked up to a pitcher in the dugout and said, hey, when player Y comes up, drill him. So it's happened. It's happened both ways. It hasn't happened a lot, but it has happened, and it is part of the game. It has been for generations.
Now, if a batter comes up and thinks that he's being thrown at and things are getting tense, are there things you would say to diffuse the situation?
Yeah, especially if we hadn't tried to hit him intentionally. Usually if we tried to hit the person or it was an intentional plunking, I wouldn't say anything. I just try to strategically place myself between him and the pitcher in case he rushed out there. But if it was an accident, if we actually weren't trying to hit the batter and we did, then I'd try to explain to him that we weren't trying to hit him.
In general, is there much conversation between you and batters? I mean, can you ever get into a batter's head? Do you ever try and do that?
I didn't do it too much. You know, when I was hitting, I didn't, other than to say hello to the catcher, unless I was good friends with him, I didn't want to talk too much, and I know how hard hitting is. So I kind of left hitters, I left them alone when they walked in, other than to say hello. You know, there was a lot of guys who I played against for a lot of years, so certainly I'd say hello, how you doing? After that, it was business. Now, there are, you know, a handful of friends that I've known for decades that would come to the plate, and I might joke around with them. But as a general rule, other than a hello, we both had a job to do.
Well, Brad Ausmus, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Brad Ausmus caught 18 seasons in the big leagues. He's a three-time Gold Glove winner and ranks seventh all-time for most games caught. He's now a special assistant to the general manager for the San Diego Padres. Now here's that scene from the classic baseball film Bull Durham we just spoke about. Here, catcher Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, has called for a curveball to start a hitter. On the mound, his pitcher Nuke LaLouche, played by Tim Robbins, disagrees. The scene is slightly edited for clarity.
Why is he calling for a curveball? I want to bring heat. Shake it off. Throw it you want.
Damn it. Time out. Hey! Why are you shaking me off? Huh?
I want to bring the heater to announce my presence with authority.
To announce your what?
Announce my presence with authority.
To announce your presence with authority? This guy's a first ball fastball hitter. He's looking for heat.
Oh, yeah? So what? He ain't seen my heat.
All right, mate. Give him your heat.
Why is he always calling me meat? I'm the guy driving a Porsche.
Fastball. Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he?
Look at that, he hit the ball.
Guy gets a free steak.
You having fun yet?
Oh, yeah, I'm having a blast, thanks.
Good. God, sucker teed off in that like he knew I was going to throw a fastball.
He did know.
How?
I told him.
Sly Stone is known to millions from the records he made with Sly and the Family Stone. But he had a career before he and the family got together, and at one point had his own record label, Stoneflower. Rock historian Ed Ward says Stone's other work adds another dimension to the career of this enigmatic character.
When you think of Sly Stone, this is not the sort of thing which immediately comes to mind. It's Free Advice, a single by the Great Society, recorded in December 1965, and featuring Jerry Slick, his wife Grace, and his younger brother Darby. It may not sound like it, but it took 53 takes to get this one, and the reason for that is right on the record label, which says, produced by Sly Stewart. By the time this was released, the young producer, a notorious perfectionist, had been working for Autumn Records, a label run by San Francisco DJ Tom Donahue and his partner Bob Mitchell, for 2 years. Donahue undoubtedly knew Sylvester Stewart as a fellow DJ who held down a slot on KSOL in the East Bay, and also knew that while Sly Stone, as he was known on the air, loved soul music, he was also way into British rock. Thus, when Donahue brought a band into the studio that he'd discovered in a San Francisco North Beach club, his young producer knew just what to do with them.
Follow your own beaten path. Wonder where you can be grand. Be aware of hidden dangers and don't you go talking to strangers.
Don't Talk to Strangers was the fourth charting single Sly had produced with the Beau Brummels, and while it did okay nationally, it was a big enough hit locally that the band was soon scooped up by Warner Brothers. Sly kept busy for Autumn, though, producing hits and misses for the Mojo Men and the Vegetables with a J, whose lead singer and drummer was Jan Errico. If that name sounds familiar, it might be because her cousin Greg was soon to emerge as the drummer in Sly's new band, The Family Stone. When Autumn fell apart early in 1966, Sly was already producing some sessions for Billy Preston, playing in San Francisco with his band The Stoners, and cutting demos with his brother Freddie's band, which already show the fusion of rock and funk.
We got you going, or
what? Wait, don't.
You really got me? Take four.
In 1967, the personnel of the Family Stone had gelled, and they are on their way to million sellers, Woodstock, and crossover success. In 1969, Sly and his manager Dave Kaperlik incorporated Stone Flower Productions, and soon they were approached by Atlantic Records, offering them a label in which to play Sly's productions. Sly's first two signings for the label were an old friend, Joe Hicks, and a trio called Little Sister, which did indeed have his little sister Vieta, known as Vet, and two of her friends. Little Sister had been a gospel outfit, but like Vet's big brother, they liked to experiment, and they didn't get many bookings. So Sly signed them. There was no doubt about who was backing them up, of course, and You're the One made it to 22 on the pop charts. The follow-up didn't do as well, but it did give a bit of insight into the new sound Sly was playing with. Stoneflower single by Joe Hicks remains one of the most disturbing records I've ever heard.
Good and the bad, big and the small, in and out, not at all. If it feels good, it's alright. If it feels good, it's alright. Tell me when you feel it.
The extreme compression, the minimalist backing dominated by the ace tone rhythm ace machine, and the lack of chord progression makes Life and Death in G and A a claustrophobic, paranoid experience. Sly was onto something else now, about to release There's a Riot Going On, and then disappear for 2 years.
Ed Ward lives in France. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the film Mysteries of Lisbon. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Raul Ruiz was born in Chile in 1941, but fled to France after the 1973 coup. Living in exile, he's directed more than 100 films, many experimental and with international casts. Mysteries of Lisbon is a wide-ranging Napoleonic-era drama made in 6 episodes for European television, but cut down to 4.5 hours for a theatrical release. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
70-year-old Chilean-born director Raul Ruiz has made over 100 films, only a few of which have been distributed in the U.S., but he's beloved at festivals and in film studies programs everywhere. I've seen 7 of his movies, and 5 struck me as less than meets the eye. Not just difficult, but pointlessly disorienting. The disjunctions, like manic tics, meant to break up the relationship between image and language. Critic Jonathan Rosenbaum called Ruiz's works irresponsible, not merely in their dogged marginality, but also in their refusal to aspire to the rigor or consistency of masterpieces, their total unwillingness to marshal their forces in any single concerted direction. Yes, indeedy, except Rosenbaum thought that was a good thing. Ruiz finally won me over, though, with his 1999 Proust adaptation, Time Regained. Actually, adaptation is the wrong word. It was a translation from one medium to another, in which Ruiz managed to create a Proustian stream of consciousness on film. He wasn't undermining narrative for the sake of being a narrative underminer. He was evoking the way emotions transform our view, spatially and temporally, of the past. He was, like Proust, bending time. Now comes Ruiz's Mysteries of Lisbon, based on a novella, unavailable in English, by the prolific 19th-century Portuguese author Camilo Castelo Branco. It's in Portuguese and French and 4.5 hours, the pacing on the slow side. Sound tempting? Maybe not. But it turns out the film is enthralling. And also, if you're willing to relax and go with the flow, as juicy and accessible as a great soap opera, and with a sting in its tail. It opens like a Dickens novel. Its apparent protagonist, a bookish and sad boy named Pedro, who lives in a boarding house run by the supremely empathetic Father Dinis. Pedro is branded a bastard by other boys and seems to be an orphan. But as the film progresses, we learn the secret of his origin, and then the secret of his parents' origins, and the origins of people who saved his life and continue to determine his fate. Point of view is passed like a baton, from character to character. There are multiple narrators, flashbacks within flashbacks, incredible coincidences, and people who shed one identity and pick up another, and another. Yes, it's confusing, but the confusions are momentary and reinforce the overriding motif, that in this rigorously Catholic and class-based society, all surfaces are suspect. Life is a mystery play. The author Branco was something of a Portuguese social realist, but Ruiz's work is closer to magic realism, endlessly stylized. The film unfolds on what looks like the most sumptuous puppet stage ever created, with occasional cuts to an actual puppet stage on which cardboard figures are manipulated by the boy, Pedro. Is the movie the dream of the orphaned puppeteer? It's certainly dreamlike. Shot on digital video, Mysteries of Lisbon is full of long tracking shots and lengthy takes, the images painterly, the space layered. The score serves up high melodrama and lush romance, but every so often Ruiz throws in an overhead or under-the-table shot as a way of goosing you. There's always some ironic distance. Duels and military executions are viewed from odd angles. Lovers' quarrels are framed in doorways in front of which servants sit and listen as if to a good soap opera. But the characters' emotions aren't slighted. The camera is always in the right place to capture what's important, a furtive glance or a frenzied glower. And the actors are wonderful. Adriano Luz deftly juggles personas other than Father Dinis, and Ricardo Pereira has a devilishly romantic screen presence as a scarred Brazilian businessman. He has international superstar charisma. What makes this movie transcendent, a fast 4.5 hours, is that unique blend of distance and intimacy. You can study it like a series of paintings, and then realize with a gasp that it's gotten hold of you like a fever dream.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.